Case number 09-5281 et al. Teva Pharmaceuticals USA, Inc., appellant versus Kathleen Sebelius in her official capacity as Secretary of Health and Human Services et al. Mr. Shumsky for appellant, Mr. Coutini for appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mike Shumsky for Teva USA. This case raises two issues, one on jurisdiction and one on the merits, and I'd like to very briefly address both of those issues, beginning with jurisdiction. FDA has now interpreted the Hatch-Waxman Act to allow brand manufacturers to manipulate the incentive for challenging their patents by withdrawing or delisting those patents and thereby stripping the first patent challenger of its exclusivity reward. But this court flatly rejected that same approach to delisting in the Ranbaxy case.
Different statute, right?
Different statute, no question about it. As I'll argue, I don't think that the changes in the MMA changed the fundamental analysis in the Ranbaxy case, but I think the key point on jurisdiction is that FDA is now trying to evade review of that. In particular, FDA is arguing that Teva's lawsuit is prematurely filed simply because the agency hasn't applied its rule of decision with respect to delisting.
Let me ask you about that. Why not wait until April? In April, you're going to get a ruling from the FDA on this, right? The patents expire, and we'll know for certain in April how the FDA approaches this issue.
Americans take Losartan products 850 million times per year. Under FDA's approach to delisting, my clients have forfeited their exclusivity reward, and the district court has upheld that decision. And if we win...
Let's imagine a hypothetical in which we all agree one way or the other, and the opinion is assigned to me. I'm not certain it'll be out by April. I'm slow.
So That may be true, and we would ask you to rule as quickly as you can in our favor. The key point, though, is that we can't make 850 million tablets of Losartan overnight. And right now, my clients have had to account for FDA's rule and account for the district court's decision in their business planning. And it's affected every level of the company's business operations, from its relationships with its distributors to its suppliers, and obviously to its customers, the pharmacies and the wholesalers who understand that Teva's lost its exclusivity for this product. And they're beginning to enter negotiations with other companies and Teva's bargaining power.
How do we know that Teva even has exclusivity for the product?
Well, I think they're...
assuming that, but your complaint said upon information and belief. We don't know that for certain.
Well, there are two things. The first is that at page 16 of the red brief, the government concedes that Teva's Hyzar, generic Hyzar file, was filed at the agency on May 24th, 2004. FDA's website lists the date that the first Paragraph 4 certification was received for each product for which a Paragraph 4 certification has been received. The date listed on FDA's website is May 24th, 2004, the same date that our application was filed. So we know for a fact that we were first. But second, FDA has now had 9 months to dispute whether or not we were first, and they haven't disputed it because it's not in dispute. Everybody understands that Teva was first to file on these products. The industry is aware of it. Our customers are aware of it. And the decision that FDA has announced is ripe for review because it's having a present impact on our business. And I think, you know, this court has a long line of cases that recognize that where an agency's decision is fully crystallized, where there is no serious possibility that the agency's position will be revisited, an applicant like Teva has the right to pre-enforcement review and challenge to that decision, provided that they can demonstrate some current hardship from the rule. And that's exactly what's happening in this case. As I said before, our client relationships, our relationships with distributors and suppliers are being impacted by this rule. And unless we get prompt judicial review...
You call it a rule. That sort of assumes one of the issues here, right? In fact, it's not a rule. For advocacy purposes, you call it a rule, but it was something that came out of an adjudicatory proceeding, right?
I think that's entirely fair, Your Honor. I would concede that this was an adjudicatory proceeding.
So it presents itself in a much different posture than if we were looking at a rule or a regulation, right?
In some respects, it does. In
for example, in your adjudicatory, in your proceeding, they could change their view as long as they gave a reasoned basis for doing so.
I think there is a remote possibility that
well,
that
the
would
point,
be the case.
Is we're not absolutely certain that this is what's going to that in fact your case is going to turn out the way you think it will.
Well,
isn't that the classic example for us to stand back?
We made the point in the Association of Bituminous Contractors that in the case of a rule, the agency can also, say a rule produced by formal rulemaking, the agency can also change that. I mean, exactly this argument about changeability was made there and rejected.
Well, that's true. I think I have two responses to that. The first is that FDA's position really isn't in doubt because they've now defended it on the merits in this court as the only permissible interpretation of the statute. And it would be very unusual for an agency to represent in this court that its position is compelled by the statute and then turn around in 90 days and interpret the statute in a fundamentally different way. But second, and I think far more important, there is a line of cases in this court that begins with the IBEW versus ICC case, which was cited as one of our principal cases at page 14. The district court relied upon it, that recognize that a party that participates in an adjudication, as Teva did here, might prevail in the underlying adjudication in an as-applied challenge to an adjudicatory rule of decision, but they nonetheless have standing to challenge the application of that rule on a prospective basis, provided that they can demonstrate some hardship or some harm for that rule. And Judge Williams, you recognize that as well in the Sealand decision. And that's exactly what happened in this case. Teva participated in the underlying adjudications by submitting comments in Acarbose. Those comments were reiterated in the COSOP decision. FDA, on the record in both of those proceedings, considered and rejected, quote-unquote, Teva's argument. And we now have a case in which that rule of decision, albeit one that was announced in the process of an adjudicatory proceeding, is going to divest Teva of its exclusivity. I think if there were any doubt about the agency's position, this might be a different case. But given that the agency's decision is fully crystallized, I don't think we're in a situation where the difference between adjudication and rulemaking is dispositive with respect to the jurisdictional questions. So if I can, I'd like to spend a little bit of time explaining why the district court, which did, after all, reach the merits of this case, got that analysis wrong. And there are really three points that I want to make. First point. FDA's rule of decision with respect to delisting opens up the Hatch-Waxman Act to the worst form of brand manufacturer manipulation. Under FDA's rule, which says that they are compelled to delist a patent whenever requested by the NDA holder for whatever reason, a brand manufacturer can sue the generic applicant for patent infringement, force the generic applicant to spend years and millions of dollars litigating. And then, when it appears that the brand manufacturer is going to lose its case, it can turn around and punish the generic applicant by delisting that patent and stripping them of their exclusivity. There's not a shred of evidence to think that when Congress passed the MMA, they intended to open up the Hatch-Waxman scheme to that form of manipulation. To the contrary, the changes that Congress made to the MMA were designed to prevent brand manufacturer manipulation. And that's really the second point, which relates to the new delisting counterclaim mechanism. That provision of the statute, which expressly references patent delisting, says if a generic applicant is sued by the brand manufacturer, it now has the right to bring a counterclaim seeking a court order compelling the brand manufacturer to delist that patent. And that was an essential addition to the MMA because for a number of years prior to the statute's passage, brand manufacturers would list what Congress called spurious patents in the Orange Book, patents that claimed unapproved uses or claimed different drugs. But they would then sue the generic applicant and get an automatic stay for 30 months of the generic file's approval. And generics tried to fight those kinds of tactics by bringing counterclaim actions. And the courts, including this court, held that generics weren't allowed to do that because the statute didn't give them that shield. It didn't give them a private right of action to force the brand manufacturer to delist. MMA took direct aim at those decisions, and it gave generic applicants a shield. It said, if you face a lawsuit by a brand manufacturer where they're asserting a spurious patent, you can now do what the court said you couldn't do before. You can bring a counterclaim and force the brand manufacturer to delist that patent. And then it put a minor limit on that shield. It said, but if you take advantage of the shield we're giving you, and then you sit on your exclusivity right and prevent consumers from getting access to the drugs by abusing your exclusivity, you'll lose the exclusivity. But outside of that context, there's no evidence and no basis for thinking that Congress intended to do what FDA had done in this case, which is to take that shield for generics and turn it into a sword for brand manufacturers by allowing them to engage in the very kind of manipulation that this court condemned in the Ranbaxy decision. And the last point I want to make is none of the other parts of the statute that Ranbaxy relied upon fundamentally alter the analysis or the rule of decision that this court announced in Ranbaxy. We know that the commercial marketing trigger is still in the statute. And FDA's approach to delisting is just as inconsistent with the commercial marketing trigger today as it was before, because as the court recognized in Ranbaxy, if a brand manufacturer delists a patent and you're not able to start your exclusivity period by launching, then the commercial marketing trigger has essentially been written out of the statute. And the same problem...
Well, isn't one difference that you have to add, in this case, a qualification to CC, capital CC, right? In the
as I said in the district court, we all wish there were more subsections, but I know the provision you're talking about. Sorry, what's the limitation that we need to add?
So here we are at J5I.
D1 double BB lowercase CC.
Little b, and then we get finally to double big CC.
Yes.
Where, you know, I mean, it speaks of withdrawn by the holder of the application. So you have to add to that under the circumstances of there having been a counterclaim.
Well, I don't think that we do. I mean, if you look at the way that the statute is structured, and in order, the statute creates the counterclaim provision that references delisting before it gets to the forfeiture trigger. That is to say, in J5C, Congress says, if you're sued, you can bring a counterclaim seeking a court order requiring the brand manufacturer to delist. And then in the next provision, which begins J5D, Congress put some limitations, one of which is if there is a delisting, you can lose your exclusivity. And our argument is simple. It's that you read those sequential provisions of the statute in order and with the natural link that's between them. And to the extent that our argument is you can only have a delisting in response to a counterclaim, there would be no reason for Congress to have included some sort of express cross-reference in the double C provision. As the government itself observed in its brief, the counterclaim provision, or rather the counterclaim itself, can only be brought in the course of patent litigation. So if Congress had included an express cross-reference in that provision, it would have been redundant. And the fact that they didn't only illustrates the logic of our point. But again, what I really want to leave you with is there's no evidence in the MMA that Congress intended to fundamentally upend the statutory scheme and allow brand manufacturers to engage in the kind of manipulation that this rule allows them to engage in. And our interpretation of the statute, which reads these provisions, the only two provisions of the statute that expressly reference delisting, as being linked to each other, makes every other part of the statute work. It gives life to the commercial marketing trigger. It gives life to the exclusivity incentive. It gives life to the delisting counterclaim provision. And indeed, it gives life to the forfeiture provision that references delisting, because under those circumstances where a generic applicant raises the shield and obtains a counterclaim order requiring the brand manufacturer to delist, but then sits on its exclusivity, it will lose its exclusivity right. But where the generic applicant does nothing of its own to deprive consumers of prompt access to generic medicine, where they don't abuse their exclusivity right, there's no basis for punishing them. In this case, Teva filed the first paragraph 4 challenge to this $1.5 billion drug, and as a result of that decision, consumers are going to have access to generic Losartan 4.5 years earlier than they otherwise would. The American public is going to save billions of dollars as a result of what Teva did in this case. And there is no sound basis for taking Teva's reward away, given the benefits that it's delivered to consumers. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Mr. Coutini.
May it please the court, I'm Drake Coutini on behalf of the Secretary. Commissioner Hamburg and the Food and Drug Administration. With me today are Shoshana Hutchinson and Elizabeth Dickinson from the Food and Drug Administration. In this case, Teva seeks judicial review of decisions made by FDA when it approved two other manufacturers' ANDAs in 2008. Those are with respect to Acarbose and Cosopt. Teva contends that FDA will apply certain aspects of those decisions to Teva's ANDA when it becomes eligible for approval in April of 2010. Teva further contends that FDA will, at that time, deny that Teva has 180 days of exclusivity because it will conclude that it has been forfeited. Now, first of all, as we point out in the brief, these two decisions made in these other adjudications are not a rule. They're simply two adjudications made with respect to two other ANDAs.
As far back as 1978, that didn't prevent this court from finding ripeness for it. This is Association of Bituminous Contractors versus Andrus, where in one agency adjudication, the agency pronounced a principle, an interpretation of the statute, and then a completely different set of people challenged that ruling in district court. And the court found that the case was right, even though none of the people had, the people actually challenging in that case, had an adverse ruling for themselves. We do abandon that case?
Well, I don't believe that's relied upon by Teva.
No, but it's part of our law, okay. Right?
Well, this case is more...
And IBEW versus ICC is relied on them. So I don't know. I'm not sure what your answer to that is.
Well, in the IBEW case, what was permitted there was the participant in the administrative proceeding...
Who had won,
but he did not like the fact that the ICC reviewed the arbitration.
Right.
And he challenged that procedural aspect of what had happened, but he had been a participant in that very adjudication.
How does that actually make a difference?
Well, it makes a difference because in this...
It's in no way distinguishes association of broadcasting, of bituminous contractors.
Well, in this case, FDA has not applied the statute, and that's what we're talking about here is the terms of the statute. Teva is challenging the way the statute works, and FDA has not applied the statute to Teva's ANDA.
That's true in an ordinary challenge to a rule to which the Association of Bituminous Contractors analogized the same sort of challenge, right? In other words, an agency can, it's perfectly clear, adopt an interpretation conclusively in the course of an adjudication, just as it can in a rulemaking. And in 1978, we saw no objection, no ripeness objection to our entertaining the objection.
Well, what they want to challenge is one minor legal issue.
You call it minor, but, I mean, they see it as rather major, and I have to say, looking at the, and I'm not sure that would make any difference anyway, but it looks rather major in terms of the incentive structure set up by the statute.
Well, the way the statute is structured, the statute lists six forfeiture events, and several of those could occur between now and April of 2010, such as withdrawal of the application, amendment of a certification, agreement with another applicant in a way that would involve the antitrust laws.
I haven't heard anything that is at the sole discretion of the brand manufacturer yet.
Well, FDA, until the approval is, until time for approval arrives in April 2010, it does not make these decisions because any of these events could occur.
Are you saying that the principle adopted in these two prior cases, and which you say is required under Chevron 1, is an interpretation that the FDA may, in the next few months, abandon?
No, we're not saying that at all. If there
but
are,
I didn't see a clue in that direction in your brief.
No, we're not saying that. What we are saying is that the statute lists six forfeiture events. We don't know until time for approval what the final status of
in the Association of Bituminous Contractors, we didn't know that any of the contractors were going to run afoul of the rule that the agency had adopted.
We don't know that TEVA will be approved. We don't know that there are any other ANDAs that will be approved that will be blocked.
Well, what is the obstacle to approval? What is the potential obstacle?
They have
tentative approval.
Tentative approval. Prior to final approval, they must submit an amendment to FDA to demonstrate to FDA that nothing has changed since FDA's review, prior review of their product. They have to assure FDA that the labeling is the same. If the NDA holder changes labeling, they would be required to change their labeling to coincide with that. They have to convince FDA that the chemistry, the sources for their raw materials, their manufacturing process, none of that has changed. And that makes this case very similar.
I have to say it. The mere probability that circumstances will change seems pretty weak, particularly as I say in this earlier case, we thought there was no Reichert's problem when there wasn't even any violation involved of the rule that the agency had adopted.
Well, in Pfizer, Pfizer wanted to prevent FDA from approving any other ANDAs, and in that case it was challenging Mylan's ANDA, and it had been tentatively approved. And this court held that that makes it more likely that Mylan, in that case, would get final approval, but it held that Pfizer's challenge was still not ripe, even though Pfizer said...
My recollection is that in Pfizer we rely on all kinds of factual possibilities that had not been developed.
Well, the same...
More substantial than what you're pointing to now, the possibility that the grounds for approval already obtained will suddenly be pulled out from under TEVA.
What Pfizer said it wanted to challenge was a discrete legal issue, which was FDA's interpretation of the statute as it pertained to dosage form, which FDA had made final in responding to a citizen petition. That's what Pfizer said it wanted to challenge, that and only that legal issue on dosage form. And that's what TEVA is saying here. We only want to challenge this one legal issue about this one forfeiture provision. And what this court said in Pfizer was that could lead to piecemeal review, because assuming that Mylan's ANDA is given final approval, it could happen at that time that Pfizer would bring other challenges to that approval. And in this very situation, one of the administrative decisions in this case, challenged by TEVA in this case, which was the COSOPT matter, in that case, Hi-Tech came into court prematurely, as did TEVA. Judge Bates held that there was no final agency action in that situation. And then ultimately in litigation, Hi-Tech attempted to raise another issue in addition to the patent withdrawal forfeiture issue. It tried to raise another reason why its 180 days hadn't been forfeited. It was this overlapping of the 180 days and pediatric exclusivity. The district court rejected that, but nonetheless it came up with another reason why its 180 days hadn't been forfeited. And that is exactly what this court held in Pfizer. It held that if we decide this one discrete legal issue now before this has been applied, the statutory interpretation has been applied to the final decision of FDA, it could happen that Pfizer will come into court and raise other issues after final approval. This court said that would lead to piecemeal review, and we're not going to do that, and that's why it's not ripe. And the very thing could happen here. In the other administrative decision that they challenged, the Acarbos decision, Cobalt raised in the administrative proceeding that the other generics shouldn't be approved if they didn't use the same bioequivalence method that we used. Now, it did not raise that in litigation, but this is a type of issue that generic drug companies often raise, that other generics shouldn't be approved for various reasons, one of which Cobalt asserted administratively was that the others did not use the same bioequivalence method. And that what this court held in Pfizer was, we are not going to review a discrete legal issue, even though it's more likely now that Mylan may get final approval because it could lead to piecemeal review. And this court further held that there's no hardship to Pfizer to make them wait until there is a final decision by the Food and Drug Administration in applying this legal principle, in that case to Pfizer's ANDA. There's no hardship to make them wait and seek judicial review upon a final agency decision. And the same is true in this case. There's no hardship to Teva to make it seek judicial review when a final decision is made. At that time, all of the factors that FDA is required to consider under the statute, under the forfeiture provisions, and everything else will be final. FDA will render a final decision when it is appropriate to do so, and prior to that, there's no final agency action. And their harm, basically what they said to this court was their harm was business planning. We need to know now so we can plan our future. That very type of harm was rejected by the Supreme Court.
I mean, there are two problems with the National Park Association case. One is that the agency deciding didn't have authority to resolve the question. And the other is that they were the type of business planning that was considered insufficient was a question of exactly how high their bids would be, which is obviously not nothing, but it seems more substantial than enormous out-of-pocket investments, which are, seem to be at stake here.
Well, they were relying on that as hardship to satisfy the hardship analysis under ripeness, and the Supreme Court flatly rejected that. They said if we open up the courts to this type of harm, then the courts will be flooded with litigation because any business activity.
Yeah, but the court didn't purport to abandon Abbott Labs.
Correct.
And Abbott Labs does involve the hardship of essentially being of having to make investments on the basis of either make them on the basis of an illegal rule and have them wasted, or violate it and have the penalties. And here of course, the penalties was wasting investment.
Well, Abbott Labs involved a regulation that proscribed primary activity. I believe the court has used those terms. It made certain activity illegal at the time, and the court has distinguished it on that basis. Here we have nothing of the sort. The FDA has made no decision whatsoever with respect to Teva's ANDA. They are only talking about prospective harm. It's exactly the same type of harm that was raised in the National Park case, in which the court flatly rejected that as a basis for hardship.
I mean, the type of harm was only the price at which the member firms would make bids. As I say, not nothing, but not the same as large-scale purchases of facilities and so forth.
Still, what the court said was if they recognize that type of harm, it will lead to a flood of
Yeah, but that type of harm, the question is what qualifies as that type of harm.
Well, in this type of case, FDA does not, under its regulations, does not announce ahead of time who is the first paragraph four filer. Now, there may be...
You aren't contesting, are you?
In this case,
identified a date, and it seems to be their date of filing.
All that FDA identifies is the date that the first paragraph four comes in. It doesn't identify the filer. And there could be other paragraph fours who filed on the same date, but in the ordinary course,
we don't have them here.
Apotex did try to intervene, In every case, no one knows who is the first paragraph for. And we could, if this type of harm is recognized as a basis for ripeness or injury, we could have a flood of cases, not only from ANDA applicants who believe they're the first filer, we could have cases from those who know maybe that they're not the first filer and they want a declaration from the court that someone else has forfeited exclusivity. The types of questions that can be raised in under the MMA are pretty much infinite. And if it's permitted to start reviewing those before FDA has made decisions, final decisions on approval in 180 days, it could lead to...
You're out of time, but I think you should have a moment or two on the merits. In your opinions, in the FDA's opinions, it said that, of course, the manufacturer fears competition by loads of people more than it fears competition by a single person. But surely that doesn't exhaust the considerations that are involved. A brand manufacturer that is able to cut off the exclusivity period breaks the link in the incentive structure for challenges to its weak patents. By weak, I mean either potentially invalid or not infringed by the generic.
Well, the certainty of more competition if there is no 180-day exclusivity, that is, if somehow the NDA destroys the 180-day exclusivity incentive, that will lead to the certainty of much more competition for that in NDA.
I don't think the industrial organization evidence on the difference of going from two competitors to three or even to four is all that compelling. But let's put that aside. The FDA doesn't even talk about the other incentive effect, which is seems to be to simply eliminate the engine that drives the challenge to the weak patents.
Well, that's because it's speculative. There's nothing in the record.
It's speculative. I mean, it's pretty clear. I mean, it was, well, why did Congress create the exclusivity period?
Well,
I mean, to read the statute, it obviously creates the exclusivity period, right?
Correct.
To read the statute to allow the brand manufacturer to extinguish the exclusivity period at will pretty clearly eliminates the incentive structure established.
Well,
is the FDA's argument that firms in this field don't respond to incentives?
No, they respond to incentives.
You never discuss it.
But there's no evidence that of this type of manipulation. There's only speculation about that. The FDA has seen no...
I mean, don't we normally just assume that people respond to huge incentives when they're provided?
Well, it would be...
We actually have cases suggesting that.
Well, it would be more of an incentive to only have one competitor than many competitors. That is the only type of... there is evidence in the record, and it has been before FDA.
So you don't think brand manufacturers have any incentive to discourage generic producers from filing paragraph 4 certifications?
No, there's no evidence of that type of manipulation that is in the record or that I have seen.
What would you take as evidence?
Evidence? I just haven't seen anything that... would suggest that occurs.
I think we've said that we don't need evidence for the proposition that a stone unsupported will fall to the ground. I'm not sure how this is distinguishable.
Well, I mean, there is evidence that more competition is worse for an NDA than less competition.
I think we've exhausted it.
And plus, the statute provides that a patent, if it claims the product, must be listed with FDA, and if it does not claim the patent, it must not be listed. So to ascribe to NDA holders some punitive or manipulative intent when that is what the statute requires, and FDA assumes that the NDA holders list patents that they are required to list and do not list or withdraw patents that do not claim the product. So the statute provides an answer to that. It requires listing of patents that claim products and requires that they obviously not be listed if they don't claim a product. And Congress, in placing these forfeiture events in the MMA, clearly was concerned with the broader picture of getting more generic products on the market. It listed six separate forfeiture events. And obviously it intended, if you look at the legislative history that we cite, to get more generic products on the market through doing that.
Right, your time is up.
All right, that's all I have.
Thank you. Does Mr. Shumsky have any time? Okay.
Hi. In my minute, I just want to make a couple of quick points. Judge Williams, I think you really got this. FDA's position in this case is going to gut the exclusivity incentive, and there really isn't a shred of evidence that Congress intended that. Over the long run, brand manufacturers have every incentive to prevent generics from challenging their patents. That's what Rand Baxi recognized, and that's equally true today as it was a few years ago. I do want to address a couple of points on jurisdiction very quickly. One is, Judge Henderson.
No, go ahead.
One is, Mr. Guttini says there are a number of things that could happen between now and April that change. It's simply not true. Our exclusivity has already been taken away. We've lost our exclusivity under FDA's rule because we didn't launch our product 2.5 years ago. Nothing that changes between now and April is going to affect that. As far as the other things that Mr. Guttini identified, none of them are remotely possible in this case. He says there could be a withdrawal of the ANDA. I can tell you as an officer of the court, my clients aren't going to pull their ANDA for this $1.5 billion drug. He says there could be an amended patent certification. We're not going to change our paragraph 4 certification when hundreds of millions of dollars are on the line. And he says that there could be some sort of an agreement that violates the antitrust laws. Well, we have no such agreement with the brand manufacturer. Those agreements tend to come about through collusive settlements in patent litigation. And of course, the key point in this case is we weren't sued. Merck waved the white flag because we spent millions of dollars to engineer around a competition-blocking patent. And we presented such a strong invalidity and non-infringement case that Merck gave up. Under those circumstances, there really is no likelihood that Teva's going to get its exclusivity back or that anything's going to change that prevents us from losing that exclusivity in April. I want to identify two cases that I think are relevant to the court's consideration of whether or not the case is ripe. The first is Kootenai Electric Company versus FERC 192 F3rd 144. Where this court recognized that bargaining harms or competitive injuries that happen as a result of agency action can be immediately remediated. The other case is Wisconsin Public Power versus FERC 493 F3rd 239, where it recognized the same principle. Again, the harms recognized in those cases, which are disruption in the plaintiff's relationship with its business partners, are sufficient to generate the ripeness necessary for constitutional and prudential purposes. And again, that's exactly what's happening in this case. Americans take this product 850 million times per year, and unless we get prompt judicial review of FDA's decision, we're not going to be in a position to distribute enough product to consumers come April when our file will be approved. If the court has no further questions, I'd like to rest.